Property? Properties?
Come on up.
May it please the court, Lars Nesty for the appellants Boyd Widener. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, everyone looks over at the bailiff. The bailiff has nothing to do with reserving time. I'm the one that gets to do
that. May I reserve 3 minutes? Thank you.
Unlike some other courts.
This is an implied easement case, and the appellant's case was dismissed on summary judgment, and there was a written ruling from the trial court that focused primarily on a lack of evidence concerning prior use. And the case goes back to...
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Judge Leach is kind of a sharp operator, so he offers to sell me a parcel of land out in the woods, and then we get pretty close to the end of the deal, and then he tells me, you know, it's landlocked. And I say, okay, yeah, it's landlocked. So I close the deal, and I sign a thing that I acknowledge that it's landlocked. That's legal, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can I sue him 3 years later for an easement by implication?
No.
Even if I have a necessity for it?
No.
Even if it would be better for me and cheaper for
me?
No. And why is that? Why can't I do that?
The nature of implied easement is a claim in equity, and as the cases point out, the cardinal consideration is the presumed intention of the parties.
Right. So
and in your hypothetical,
So here, it's what we intended. I was buying a landlocked parcel, and presumably I got a discount if I didn't own a helicopter, right?
Correct.
Okay. So here. Your client's interested in buying a parcel of land. Ask the seller to sell him more than that. The seller tells him no. And then he closes anyway. How is that any different from my situation with Judge Leach?
The difference is we know your intention with Judge Leach because you spoke about property being
And we know the seller's intention was not to sell anymore.
We don't.
Not sure we do.
We don't.
He was asked to sell it, and he declined to do so.
In terms of a sale, yes.
Yeah.
This is an implied easement case.
Well, it's the intention of the parties. We've already talked about that.
Well, we would argue
the seller's intention was not to give you any interest in that land.
We would argue that was not their. First of all, it's an implied easement, right? And the implication is that
there was an intent
from the surrounding circumstances in the transaction.
Well, but but one of those circumstances is I'd like to buy that. Answer, no, won't sell it to you.
Yeah.
No, I won't sell it to you. That's a pretty strong declaration. I don't intend to give you any interest in this land. I won't even take money for it.
If we viewed that in a vacuum and just looked at a chunk of property and there was no question as to whether or not there was an existing road there and that property was marketed as having a driveway, and the only way in the marketing remarks to access the property in terms of the particular portion you're speaking of that was being bargained mm-hmm. for was via this driveway.
Explain why somebody would want to buy it.
Well,
how do we get past the fact that the other party didn't want to sell it?
Again, I think
we know
have to look
so.
At the surrounding circumstances of that bargain. And our position would be that the surrounding circumstances...
I'll sell you less of it. That's actually what happened, right?
Correct.
I'll sell you less of it.
What I'll do is I'll sell you a portion that's landlocked.
I'll sell you less
without,
of it.
Without, like you well, did
no,
in your,
but
in your
it, we had the original,
without telling us.
There was the original discussion. Then it was like, I want to buy more. No. I'll sell you more, but not as much as you wanted.
But right? That, now that right there
that
is
happened,
your
right?
hypothetical. What's missing...
Isn't that what happened?
What's missing... is, in your hypothetical, both parties acknowledge the portion that I'm selling you is landlocked. And that is the issue here.
Well, no, it's not landlocked. It just has an undesirable access.
No, it is landlocked, Your Honor. So we have...
Okay, what are you saying is landlocked?
the portion of property that was added to, so you have lots 4 and 5, and then there was a bargain between the plaintiffs and the defendant to add property to lots 4 and 5. That added section, okay, which is the desirable section on the flat building lot.
That's not a separate parcel, is it?
It is not a separate parcel, but it's separate dirt. It was part of lot 3 or the tract.
You could only develop a parcel. Is that also true?
Pardon me?
You would be developing a parcel if you built on this property.
Correct.
And there is access to the parcel, is there not?
The only access to that parcel is from the bottom of lots 4 and 5.
And that's the same access being used for the construction occurring on lots 4 and 5?
There is no construction occurring on lots 4 and 5. If you're talking about the adjacent parcels,
yes.
6 and 7, no, they access the driveway. Nobody goes from the bottom of Gear Lane up the hill on their parcels. What I was focusing on, Your Honor, if I could, is the...
Let me ask you another question.
Sure.
Your time's or not. You allege that there is prior use to access lot 4 and 5 across this uphill road. What evidence in the record supports that assertion?
There are photographs in the listing that show a driveway.
Okay,
there is a reference.
How does that show what happened in times past?
Well, there's a driveway that is not grown over. And do we have
I've got a
photos of
driveway behind my house? Someone might think it gets used as a parking area if you just looked at a photograph. But nobody's ever used it.
Well, so there is a driveway. There's testimony, there's deposition testimony from the principal of the defendant that he added gravel to that driveway, that he cleared a flat building area, that he stored materials in that area. There's no access to this area except through the driveway because of the topography. So it's the only way to get to that portion of property that Judge Dwyer is saying the parties bargained for is through that driveway.
No access
without spending $10,000 or $15,000.
Without spending and technically granting an easement, right? Because 4 and 5, if we did this transaction, Judge Dwyer, in your hypothetical, without owning lots 4 and 5, it was landlocked. And I think it's interesting to look at it from that perspective. There'd be no question that it was landlocked at that point because there's no way to get, you know, to get out of that portion of the tract or lot 3 except through the driveway. There are no other easements.
You'll have 3 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Smith representing Sunflower Properties. And, of course, this property was not landlocked. And as you pointed out, Judge Dwyer, there was a negotiation with regard to access from Upper Gear Road, which was declined. And the circumstances and the evidence that's being proposed in the briefing, and we discussed this at Respondents Brief 10 and again at 27, as evidence of prior use, prior apparent and continuous use, it's a statutory warranty deed from 1972. That's their evidence. There was simply no evidence in this record that there was either continuous or apparent prior use. And what we have is exactly the hypothetical, with the exception that this property isn't landlocked. In fact, it's being accessed from Lower Gear Lane, which is exactly what the Form 17 established as the basis for access at the present time. The photographs that are being alleged to show that there was somehow some access, which, as you point out, Judge Leach, doesn't really prove anything, were stricken from the record. And there was no objection made to that in this appeal. Unless the court has any further argument or consideration or wants me to talk any more about the implied easement claim, which I think the trial court properly rejected on summary judgment, given the fact that there was absolutely no evidence of apparent or continuous use, I'd like to talk about the fact that our fee request was denied, even though the allegations that were being made as the basis for an implied easement all were directly related to supposed misrepresentations, which weren't misrepresentations, in the Form 17, and the fact that these parties entered into this agreement after this negotiation for easement was unsuccessful, after the purchasers in this of this property had had not taken their 30 days to decide whether the property was suitable for their purposes, and that's the argument that's being made to you here today, that in fact it wasn't suitable to the, to their purposes, and yet the court denied our request for fees, even though the purchase and sale agreement, which was the basis for their implied easement claim, had a provision in it that said that a prevailing party with regard to a claim that concerned the agreement was entitled to fees.
Well, was the written agreement here anything other than evidence?
It was, I get, well, I mean, like, was it anything other than evidence? Well, perhaps not, but it was the basis for the claim that was being made for an implied easement. And so given the language of the fee provision.
The basis for the claim was that there was a transaction.
Correct. And the transaction involved this purchase and sale agreement. It concerned this purchase and sale agreement.
Do any of the words within the purchase and sale agreement matter to the claim beyond the fact that there was a sale from the defendant to the plaintiffs?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of the question, Your Honor.
Any of the words that are in the purchase and sale agreement matter to the claim that the plaintiffs are making beyond the fact that there was a sale from the defendant to the plaintiffs?
The words in the agreement, no, but the words that weren't in the agreement were relevant to that, and I don't think that you can construct a complaint that asserts a claim that is only that you can only bring because this claim wasn't included
how would the plaintiff's claim be any different if instead of having a purchase and sale agreement they had just met out on the sidewalk, there was a statutory warranty deed handed by the defendant to the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs handled a cashier's check to the defendant, and they went their separate ways without any preliminary documents?
Well, the claim would be different because it would not be the basis for the claim that was made here, which was that the disclosure form completely misrepresents the access to the property, and that was the duty of Sunflower as the seller in this purchase and sale agreement to properly disclose this material issue to potential buyers. We quote that at Respondent's Brief 48 in making our fee request. So if you, and I think it's relevant in this case that...
Well, doesn't it come down to whether the writing is the source of the legal obligation or is just simply evidence?
It might be in a case such as Bogich where the fee provision was limited to enforcement of the agreement. But it isn't, and we've cited numerous cases where alleged equitable claims caused a fee provision to be triggered when the fee provision instead asserts it is concerns or relates or arises out of the sale agreement. And I don't think that you can construct a complaint that purports to create an equitable right of action under circumstances such as this, where the right of action that you are asserting is one that is depends upon an alleged intention that is reflected in the party's purchase and sale agreement, and which is... It's not just a matter of whether your claim is based on that. It's also a matter of whether the defense is, we negotiated this and our intention is reflected in the fact that we did not provide you an easement under these circumstances. And under those circumstances, these parties contemplated that this sale, this transaction, would be one that if the parties had a dispute concerning it, there would be fees that could be awarded to the prevailing party. And you shouldn't be able to get off scot-free with a claim that requires the parties that requires the court to look at the parties' intentions and say, but don't look at the contract that reflects our intentions, because then I might have to pay fees for this thing that I wasn't willing to pay for, or that my seller wasn't willing to sell to me.
Couldn't this have been written more broadly if that was the intent?
I don't...
As against the other, concerning, arising out of, or in any way related to?
It certainly could have been. I don't think it needed to be. And, I mean, what were they supposed to do? Say, including the fact that, you know, 8 years later you're going to come in and say that you have an implied easement that I refuse to give you expressly? I mean, concerning is as broad a term as arising out of. This certainly isn't, you know, an insurance policy.
See that have the three things I just said are twice redundant.
Well, you know, that's an interesting drafting question. Certainly, each of the cases that we relied upon in our briefing are not ones in which you say three times exactly the same thing. Some of them are arising out of them, some of them are related to, some of them are concerning. I guess I would see those terms as evoking the same thing that you're not just enforcement. Beg pardon?
Aren't you telling us they're synonymous?
Yes. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. And, you know, if my associate brought me an agreement or a brief with the three of them, I'd probably take out two. So that's the only answer I have to that.
Does agreement in the agreement, capitalized A agreement, concerning this agreement, that word agreement, does that mean transaction or does it mean the document?
I think that it means...
That's what this comes down to, right?
It does. And I think it means the transaction.
You should think it means that. Tell me why that would be so.
Because of the use of the term concerns. And I guess this gets to... This isn't an argument, actually, that was made in this case. So I can just sort of...
Yeah, but you're messing with my case.
I'm messing with your case, yeah.
I
mean, that's sort of a merger argument. And that claim hasn't been made in this case. But merger only applies in circumstances where the deed, for instance... I mean, your argument is basically that this would have merged into the deed, or at least... That's the way I would interpret your agreement. And our cases actually don't allow merger under those circumstances unless the claim that's being made is somehow, unless the defense that's being created in this case is somehow inconsistent with the deed itself. And that's not the case here. And I can actually provide you with some additional authority on that and will.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In the final time that I have, I'd like to point out that this, of course, was a summary judgment. And contrary to what counsel said, there was evidence that was... The record is very confusing in terms of what was stricken and what was admitted because there were supplemental declarations. But the record is very clear that there were, in fact, photographs showing a driveway and showing the existence of that driveway. There's deposition testimony from both parties that driveway existed. There's a declaration from my client that that's how they access the property. So there, it's undisputed that there was, in fact, a driveway there.
That isn't the issue. It's what use was made
correct.
Of the driveway.
That's right.
No one disputes that there's something on the ground that you can see. It's how did people use it in times past?
Yes. And, of course, use, as the Adams v. Cullen case states, is not a necessary element to an implied easement claim. In fact, there is this balancing between necessity and use, and that the more necessity you have, the less use you need to show. And on summary judgment, of course, we were entitled to all reasonable inferences and to have the evidence viewed in a light most favorable to us. And we believe there was a showing of sufficient prior use, particularly in light of the evidence regarding the necessity here, which is...
In the document, does the capitalized word agreement, does that mean transaction?
That means the contract, Your Honor. And we cited to Bogich v. Landover, which we think is applicable to this circumstance, where you've got these tort claims that theoretically would not have existed but for the fact that the parties had this broker and seller contract relationship. And those duties, of course, were provided by common law, not by the contract.
In that case, the purpose of the contract, it had an evidentiary purpose. It established that the relationship existed.
The purpose of the contract created the agency and the commission.
Because the relationship had to exist for the tort claims, for there to be any duty that would be affected by the tort claims.
Yes.
So what's the analogy here? How does that play out here?
So the analogy here is, well, these are equitable claims, of course, so they're not tort claims. And so the cases, it seems, where they have found a broader than the case here fee provision to apply to tort claims that are not directly on the contract, the analysis of Brown v. Johnson and Edmonds, they seem to focus on the fact that the duty arose out of the contract and wouldn't have existed but for that. Here, and I do think the merger doctrine is applicable, because here, essentially, this is a claim of what's on my title. And that's where the analogy of the deed itself, because that's what created what was on title. And therefore, it should have been everything related to title was merged into the deed, which, of course, does not have a fee provision. Thank you.
Counsel, the court will be in recess.
All right.